To the multi-district litigation panel hearing. First of all, before we actually call the case, I want to introduce to you the panel. On my far right is Justice George Hanks from the First Court of Appeals, and then Justice Catherine Stone from the San Antonio Court of Appeals. I'm Douglas Lang from the Dallas Court of Appeals. And to my left, immediate left, is Justice Anne McClure from the El Paso Court of Appeals, and then on the far left is Justice Jane Bland from the First Court of Appeals. Of course, the case we have called today is number 07-0009, In Re Ad Valorem Tax Litigation. The parties have briefed this case very well for us. I assure you that we have pored over the materials you have provided with great interest. We have already allocated 1 hour aside for oral argument. The clerk will keep time and give you warnings. I think they've already advised you of that. We expect to take a break after the movement's argument. We assume that whether you want to or not, I guess it's up to you on reserving time for rebuttal. How much time will that be, by the way? That'll be just fine, and but we will take a quick break at that time, perhaps 10 minutes, just to allow us to break it at an appropriate time so we're not in the middle of the argument of the tax districts. Then, as I understand it, the respondents will be dividing their time. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
How will you be doing that, sir?
Well, I'm going to lead off. I'm Robert Mott, and I'll lead off and deal with relations to the previous decision and any changes in facts and implications of the tag-along rule. Then Mr. DeLosa will be dealing with the lack of fact conflicts in the Harris County decisions as he represented Harris County in those cases. I'll also touch on the lack of conflict in rulings in my case in Moore County and Mr. Brown's case in Galveston. And then Amy Keith is going to be providing arguments with respect to the lack of common fact issue and the absence of the convenience of our parties. And then Tony Brown from Galveston will deal with the constitutional implications of the special provisions that govern these matters.
That's great. That'll be fine. And we would like you to take care on your own to divide your time up. We won't ask the clerk to do that, nor will we. So we'll assume that if somebody runs out of time at the end, then that's just the way it's going to be. But it's between the counsel on your side of the courtroom. Is that all right? For our record, if we could get the appearances of those who will speak, and if we'd start first with the movement.
Stephen Phipps of the Houston office of Baker Botts. Judge Lance Lubell with Heard Robbins in Houston.
And for the respondents.
Robert Mott, Purdue Brandon Fielder Collins and Mott, Houston.
And your client is once again to be?
My clients are Bayer, Brazoria, Denton, El Paso, Ellis, Grayson, Guadalupe, Liberty, Lubbock, Moore, Tarrant, and Williamson County.
Okay, we got that clear then. Okay. Yes, sir.
Justice, good morning. Mario DeLosso with the Houston law firm of Olson & Olson. And as Mr. Mott mentioned, I represented the Harris County Appraisal District in 4 jury trials. They've, of course, been discussed in this proceeding and briefing.
Okay.
Amy Keith, Gerwin Burtz, Beeman & Brown, and I represent Jefferson County Appraisal District and the Harris County Appraisal District.
Great.
I'm Tony Brown. I'm with McLeod, Alexander, Pell, and Apfel in Galveston. We represent the Galveston Central Appraisal.
Okay.
I'm Matthew Tapper. I won't be speaking, but I represent Bell and the Clement counties.
Okay. Thank you very much for the appearances, and as I indicated, we're ready to go if you are, and so counsel for the movement, if you'll proceed.
May it please the panel, as I've introduced myself, my name is Stephen Tipps. I'm going to be making the primary argument this morning for Valero, and as I had told the court, I hope to spend about 30 minutes on that, and hope within that time to be able to address all of the issues in the case. Mr. Lubell of the Heard Robbins firm is with me primarily because he's been involved in this underlying litigation, and there may well be some factual issues that come up during the respondent's presentation that he can better deal with on rebuttal than I. Valero is here today seeking for a second time to have its taxpayer appeals, which currently number 71 cases pending in 45 district courts in 30 different Texas counties, transferred to a single pretrial court, presumably here in Travis County, for coordinated pretrial proceedings. As the panel is well aware, Valero in January of 2006 filed a similar motion, which the court considered and without oral argument denied in a unanimous opinion written by Justice Peoples in April of 2006. We are keenly aware of the fact that the panel quite literally may well be asking why it is that we think that we are entitled to what some may characterize as a second bite at the apple. And I want to address that question up front and directly, and basically there are two reasons that we are here again. The first is that in the April 2006 opinion, the panel acknowledged that Rule 13's goals might well be implicated if it turned out that different judges exercised their discretion differently in deciding similar issues with the result that there were conflicting rulings. In the months that have passed since April 2006, that has indeed happened in at least two instances. And we've briefed those, and I'll address both of those in my presentation. Second, we're here because, in our view, the panel's analysis and application in its April 2006 opinion of the common question of fact requirement, with all due respect, was inconsistent with both the Texas MDL statute, with Rule 13, with this court's own Rule 13 jurisprudence, and with the jurisprudence of the federal multidistrict litigation panel. And that jurisprudence, of course, is considerably more extensive than this panel's jurisprudence. And we submit to the panel that the decisions of the federal MDL panel should provide helpful guidance in light of the fact that the Texas statute and rule are based and modeled on the federal statute. Of course, I want to answer any questions that any member of the panel may have at any time. But unless and until there are questions, what I propose to do is to deal with those two reasons that we're back in the context of touching on the four different requirements for an MDL transfer, and then at the end, to the extent time remains, address some of the issues that the respondents have raised in their responses. So let me start with the common question of fact, which I think is probably the knottiest issue that we need to deal with in light of the approach that the panel took to that question back in April of 2006. Both the statute and the rule, as well as its federal counterpart, which is 28 U.S.C. Section 1407, require as an initial matter that there be at least one common question of fact in order to make the cases related. Notably, though, the rule and the statute require only one common question of fact. It says one or more.
Counsel, wouldn't you agree, though, that that one fact would have to be a central fact in the case? It just couldn't be any common fact?
I don't know that I do agree with that.
Okay.
The federal MDL panel has treated the common question of fact requirement essentially as a threshold matter in order to determine whether or not to move on to the ultimate and more important question, which is whether or not consolidation of these similar or related cases in a single pretrial court would promote the ends of efficiency. The federal commentators, Moore and Wright and Miller, both routinely characterize this requirement as fairly minimal. Section 112.04 of the Moore Treatise, the requirement is referred to as easily satisfied, as not difficult to identify, a provision that is interpreted quite broadly. And Wright and Miller, for their part, talk about how the requirement may be, quote, satisfied by a wide spectrum of issues. But I have to say, Justice Hanks, that beyond that, it's not entirely clear, but I think the jurisprudence suggests that there are certainly different levels of commonality. And I begin my thinking about it by starting with what seems to me to be the classic case that cries out for consolidation in a single pretrial court. And that is the case, or that is the situation when multiple lawsuits arise from a single incident. And this court, of course, faced that situation in the Hurricane Rita evacuation bus fire case. That was a case in which I doubt there was any serious argument that there was not a common question of fact, because that truly was a central core issue. I mean, that was what all of the cases were about. But in studying the cases, and again, I rely primarily on the federal cases because there are so many more of them, I have to say that beyond that, it's not entirely clear what is meant by a common question of fact. The federal MDL panel has decided a number of cases in which it dealt with the common question of fact requirement simply by looking to see if the cases that arguably were related were alike. That did they all concern the same subject matter? And what we have done as an aid to the panel this morning is include in our handout excerpts from at least three federal cases that take that approach, which I think is characteristic of the way the federal panel addresses this. The first one is probably one of the most famous of all the federal MDL cases. That's the 1991 case in which the panel transferred to the Eastern District of Pennsylvania 26,000 asbestos cases. And in that case, the court, in a very easy fashion, dealt with a common question of fact requirement by simply observing, and we've highlighted this language, that all actions contained allegations of personal injury or death as a result of exposure to asbestos or asbestos-containing products. Similarly, in our case, all of Valero's taxpayer appeals contain allegations that an appraisal district incorrectly valued Valero's property in excess of market value or unequally in relation to comparable properties. The federal court approaches this problem in terms of asking whether or not the cases are sufficiently alike, and if they are, it readily finds that there's a common question of fact.
In the case that you're describing to us, the common, the relationship of the parties is exposure to asbestos or asbestos-containing products, and the causation, there's a big question of causation there. Now, that's a fairly central issue that people will be addressing in their expert opinions and so on. You said similarly, we have issues here. Could you go into that a little bit more? Help me on that.
Well, here we have issues of valuation that are common, just as in asbestos cases there are issues of causation that are common.
Valuation on the personality that you talked
valuation
about that
of
might
this
be
property.
Similar between the districts?
Yes. The property at issue in these cases that are pending across the state is similar. There is property in convenience stores that is virtually identical from one convenience store to another. Refineries are not built with a cookie cutter, but a refinery is a refinery. And every refinery has distilling columns, has cat crackers, has storage tanks, has piping. And in deciding what the value of that property is, the experts in these cases typically look at what a distilling column generally is valued, how it generally is valued. With regard to the convenience stores, they typically look at how a cash register is generally valued. My understanding is that oftentimes the experts go on the internet to find information concerning what a particular piece of personal property is worth. And in their discovery, they routinely ask Valero to produce documents concerning the value of refineries in other states or even in other countries. So it's the commonality has to do with the value of similar, if not identical, property.
Well, wait a minute, though. The value of a package of sunflower seeds in a convenience store is very different than determining the value of a cat cracker unit.
Well,
but you're asking that basically all tax matters that Valero has brought be consolidated in front of one judge. But, I mean, evaluating a refinery and evaluating the contents of a convenience store aren't anything alike.
Well, nobody would mistake a refinery for a convenience store. And it certainly is true that the value of a package of sunflower seeds has nothing to do with the value of anything at a refinery. The fact is, though, that there are common items shared by convenience stores and refineries. These convenience stores have gasoline pumps and have underground storage tanks, as do refineries. They may be the refineries' underground storage tanks are bigger. But they do have that in common. So there is some overlap between the convenience stores and the refineries. And the statute, again, simply requires that there be one common fact issue so that the court can then go on and ask the more important question, which is, ultimately, I submit, are these cases sufficiently alike that it would promote judicial efficiency to have them all in one court rather than scattered across the state?
Let me ask you a question about that, though. I am concerned about the precedent we set if this motion is granted. I envision corporate giants of all shapes and sizes relying on an opinion granting the motion to challenge all appraisals across the state, whether it's Exxon on their gas stations or Walmart, and not only having that issue come up with multiple corporations, but happening every year that the tax appraisals don't suit them. How do we craft an opinion that is narrow enough that we don't put the tax districts in a position of every year litigating the same case over and over and over again in terms of consolidation?
Well, I hope I understand your question. These corporations who are taxpayers, of course, have the right to challenge appraisals.
No question.
And they do. Valero does, perhaps more aggressively than others, but they certainly have that right. And right now they are required to file the challenge in the local district court, and that local district court handles the case through its conclusion. And we're certainly not asking, because the rule wouldn't permit, to have the ultimate issue decided by some pretrial court. The question simply is whether these cases that are going to be filed, whether this court grants the MDL motion or not, whether they should be handled in the pretrial phase by a single pretrial court. If the court grants this motion, I would think that would provide precedent for Exxon if it chose to go the same route as Valero.
And at what expense to the taxpayers in each of these tax appraisal districts, if they're going to be litigating in parts unknown for every corporation who, I agree with you, has a right to challenge the appraisals every year? That's my question, is what is the impact on these appraisal districts year after year after year if all issues relating to the appraisals of every type of corporate-generated product is able to get MDL relief?
Well, first of all, I don't think that allowing MDL treatment would increase the amount of litigation. There's going to be companies are going to challenge appraisals if they're unhappy with them, whether we have an MDL proceeding or not.
Right, but El Paso, you're suggesting, needs to come to Austin, and Galveston needs to come to Austin, and Potter and Randall County and the Panhandle potentially would have to go wherever somebody suggests it's appropriate.
And I don't believe that that's going to impose any additional cost on appraisal districts.
Okay. If the cost is de minimis with respect to the participation in a Valero MDL, does that cost change if there becomes an Exxon MDL, a Walmart MDL, a Shell Oil Company MDL, and anybody that chooses and would potentially be able to get MDL treatment for their set of tax cases, then are we talking about a significant impact on counties?
Well, I think that's hard to predict. Certainly the court could, or the panel could, grant this motion and allow as tag-along cases not only Valero cases, but cases from other taxpayers, mm-hmm. so that a single pretrial judge could handle all of that. That is one option. That is not what I had, what we envision, but I think that's something that the panel could do. But with regard to the issue of cost, which touches on the convenience prong, we have put together for the panel a map that reflects the counties in which these cases were pending at the time we filed the motion. The number of counties has fallen some since there's been some settlements, but given the fact that in a few months we're going to have another round of appraisals, there's likely going to be litigation in those counties again. But the point that I want to make with the map, and it goes directly to Justice McClure's question about cost, is that the question, the real question, in terms of burden or cost associated with an MDL pretrial court is what individuals are going to attend these pretrial hearings. It's not going to be the experts, or at least the experts are not going to be significantly inconvenienced by that. My understanding is that in these proceedings, the only counties whose experts have ever attended a pretrial hearing are Harris County and Bexar County, and that the Harris County expert is from North Carolina and the Bexar County expert is from Harris County. So getting on an airplane to fly to Austin is as convenient for them as flying to Houston or San Antonio. The appraisal district representatives typically don't attend pretrial hearings. Nothing about this procedure would keep the trial from occurring in the local county. Nothing about this procedure would keep depositions from being taken in the local county. The significant thing, and this goes directly to cost, is that of the 38 counties, 38 districts that are involved in this proceeding, 23 of them are represented by lawyers from Austin. And so in terms of convenience and cost, it's a lot more convenient for the lawyers and a lot more cost-effective for the districts if these Austin lawyers are able to get in the car and drive to the Travis County Courthouse for a pretrial hearing than it would be, and than it currently is, for them to have to go to Lubbock or Cold Spring or Sherman or wherever these cases are pending.
Would you agree, though, that if we have consolidation and transfer, that ups the amount of, just physically increases the amount of papering that will be crossing the desks of the attorneys and the various representatives from these counties, because now you've consolidated, you have numerous more parties, and that seems to me to be a different burden than if B County's one attorney is looking at two or three lawsuits in B County as opposed to going through the information from the numerous cases that are pending?
I don't think that's true.
Why not?
I think consolidation, among other things, would minimize the number of times that certain issues need to be heard.
Could you give us an example of what one of the certain issues are that you're referencing?
The two examples that bring us here have to do with qualifications of expert witnesses. Valero has an expert witness who testifies in convenience store cases about the value of business property. The districts routinely challenge his methodology.
Is that not a question of law?
Well, that may well be a question of law, but it goes... My argument here goes not to the question of common question of fact. It goes to efficiency and ultimately to cost. But what happened in that situation is that two judges, Judge Joe Brown in San Antonio and Judge Mark Davidson in Houston, heard that challenge and rejected it. Two other judges in Harris County heard the challenge and accepted it. So you've had the same challenge made four or five times, and you have a conflict. It would be more efficient if a single pretrial judge considered whether or not the methodology used by Mr. Connolly is appropriate, made a decision, and allowed the parties to appeal that to the relevant court of appeals.
Were the approaches identical in each of those four cases?
Yes.
Were the objections the same in each of the four cases?
My understanding is that they were. I mean,
well, we don't. Your understanding, and we don't have a record on that, and we haven't seen anything articulate what methodology and what qualifications could actually be dealt with in one place for all time.
Well, we dealt with that in our. In our papers, I thought consistent with the rules in which we were asked to make assertions, and if they're not challenged, then we don't need to file evidence. We'd certainly be happy to supplement the record with evidence, but I think on the current record, the fact is that this gentleman testified in these cases. They're convenience store cases. They're virtually identical. And we had two judges rule that the methodology was improper and two rule that it was proper.
And it didn't have anything to do with different real estate in different places in the county?
No, this gentleman testifies only with regard to business personal property as opposed to real estate. And just so we're clear, we don't contend that there's a lot in common between what a piece of real estate on which a convenience store is located in Dallas is worth compared with what a piece of real estate where a similar convenience store in Harlingen is worth. I mean, real estate's intrinsically local.
Okay.
But the personal property is not. And one objection that we have to the court's or to the panel's earlier opinion is the suggestion that these decisions are highly individualized and highly local, because they are not. Again, inventory in a convenience store is worth what it's worth wherever the inventory is located, and the same is true with regard to equipment in a refinery.
Let me ask you about that point. Is that the common issue, valuation of personality in particular? Let's talk about inventory for a second. Statewide, is that the common issue?
Yes.
So the pretrial judge would be asked, under the scenario that you're suggesting, to value the three-year-old cash register in Austin and the three-year-old cash register in Brownsville.
No.
Right.
No.
No?
Under
I thought that was an example that we had. There's no difference.
Well, perhaps I misunderstood your question.
I'm asking about how this would be approached. If the issue is value of... Actually, I talked about equipment in that example and started talking about inventory. But value of personality, if that is the issue, would you be asking the pretrial judge to determine the value of the particular personality that it would be argued should be a value used statewide?
No.
Okay.
Because
how would it work?
Because the valuation of the valuation of each piece of personal property and the valuation of each piece of real property ultimately is made under the MDL system by the local judge and the local jury. That's the ultimate question. The requirement in the rule that there be a common question of fact does not mean that the pretrial judge resolves that common question of fact. What the requirement means is the requirement is a proxy for determining whether or not the cases are related, whether they're alike, and that's why in the Hurricane Rita bus case, in which the common question of fact was, did the negligence of the bus company proximately cause the fire? That question is not going to be determined by the pretrial judge in Hidalgo County. Because of that question, the existence of that question provides the underpinning for this panel's ultimate determination that efficiency and convenience and justice would be served if the cases were handled pretrial in a single court, but that doesn't mean that the question is resolved by the pretrial judge.
But now I think I'm hearing what you're saying on that. But tell us, how would this work? I mean, what are the issues then that would be decided by the pretrial judge? What are the common issues that would be decided by the pretrial judge? Because wouldn't you agree we have to evaluate what those issues are that the pretrial judge would be deciding?
They would be the same kinds of issues that are being decided every day by Judge Davidson in the asbestos MDL.
But what are they?
That's my question. They are.
I know what Judge Davidson's doing. I'm asking about prospectively what would a pretrial judge in this case decide.
They are qualifications of expert witnesses. Whether or not the experts tendered by the districts and the experts tendered by Valero meet the standards of Robinson and Havner. They are issues relating to discovery. The discovery that the districts tend to send to Valero is similar from case to case, and the pretrial judge would resolve those questions, and we would not have the kind of conflict that we've had in the past few months in which the first Court of Appeals issued mandamus in an opinion written by Justice Bland on the grounds that discovery promulgated to Valero by the Galveston County Appraisal District was not narrowly tailored, was overly broad and unduly burdensome. And then a judge in Moore County in far west Texas or north Texas, confronted with very similar discovery and similar objections, not only ordered the discovery but sanctioned Valero for not producing it. Okay. So those are the kinds of questions.
But the Amarillo Court vacated that.
Amarillo Court vacated it, but that, I mean, solved that particular problem. But that doesn't mean that there's not a risk of more conflicting rulings, nor does it mean that it's a good thing from the standpoint of efficiency for judges across the state to have to resolve these same questions over and over and over again. I'm told that the motions in limine that tend to get filed in these cases are virtually identical. A pretrial judge in a ad valorem tax MDL could do what Judge Davidson does in asbestos.
Is there limine for the trial judge?
Is that really for the trial judge?
Because that's going to be the conducting of the trial itself.
Well, the statute clearly authorizes the pretrial judge to make rulings on motions in limine, and Judge Davidson does.
Okay. Let me ask you a little bit further on this point. I thought, that the common issue was valuation. That's what I read in the briefing that everybody was crossing swords about. And the contention of the people on my left side of the courtroom here is that valuation is the ultimate issue. And over here, we're talking about, well, we have some commonality here. We have common issues, particularly as to personality. And you and I have talked about that a little bit so far. What issues, if any, as to the what determinations would the trial judge make as to the common issues regarding valuation of personality? Let's just take that piece. I've got qualification of experts, discovery conflicts, motion in limine. What else?
Scheduling of depositions. Mr. Connolly is the expert witness in all of these cases, and every district wants to depose him. That deposition could be taken once or twice or three times rather than 15 or 16 times.
How would that minimize or be more convenient for the parties? Wouldn't the experts for Valero, for instance, even if they were being used statewide, wouldn't they be testifying specifically as to the property located in the various districts?
Not really. My understanding is that, at least in the case of Mr. Connolly,
He's the personality expert?
He's the personality expert. And the testimony is about how you go about valuing personality in a convenience store. Mm-hmm. And that he has a theory that he applies to how you go about doing that. And that you can then simply take that template, if you will, and apply it to other stores based upon volume. I mean, inventory in one convenience store may be worth more than another because they stock more cigarettes. And cigarettes are valuable because people will pay a lot to buy them. But that's just math. The underlying testimony, as I understand it, is what's challenged and the way he goes about it. And so it would, the Connolly example probably conveniences Valero more than it does the districts, But it would not be inconvenient for the districts to have to take this gentleman's deposition on one or two occasions as opposed to 15 or 16. And Valero's entitled to convenience as well.
It's my
understanding, sir. Go ahead. Okay. Well, you think that every district then should be satisfied with one or two depositions globally as contrasted with them having the shot at talking to Mr. Connolly specifically about his valuation of a convenience store in Dallas County, if those were still going?
Yes, because in other MDLs, litigants are satisfied with that. In the asbestos MDL, there are certainly some witnesses, a particular plaintiff's doctor, who's going to have to be deposed because his testimony is unique to the claim of that particular plaintiff, but there are other experts who testify about causation, more general issues, who in the asbestos MDL are not deposed in every case, but they're deposed only once, and I think that it promotes efficiency, and it's efficient both for the defendant and for the plaintiff.
So Mr. Connolly wouldn't be testifying about the particular inventory in a convenience store in Harris County?
Well, I think he does testify about that, but my understanding is that the nature of his testimony in coming up with a value for the convenience store in Harris County is remarkably similar, one would not be surprised, to his testimony concerning how you value similar inventory in Dallas.
So he would still have to be called to trial in each of these counties.
Right. There's nothing that the MDL procedure can do to or should do to result in people not testifying at trials in local counties, because that's the way the system works.
Let me see if I can finally get this point clear in my mind. I was reading the motion and the consolidated reply to say that there is a common issue of valuation on some of these properties, and you've described those properties that would have common issues on valuation. Are you or are you not suggesting that the pretrial judge can make pretrial determinations on the value of particular types of property, the actual value? For instance, summary judgments could be rendered by a pretrial judge. To figure out if that would be one thing that would be requested.
Well, under Rule 13, a pretrial judge can decide summary judgment motions. My understanding, and again, Mr. LaBelle, or for that matter, these other lawyers may be able to address this better than I, my understanding and sense is that these cases are not very susceptible to summary judgment because intrinsically or inherently there's a fact issue concerning what a particular terminal or what a particular pipeline or what a particular inventory is worth. So I don't think the likelihood of dispositive summary judgments in these cases is very high. And let me quickly go back to Judge Bland's question about the sunflower seeds in the refinery. It is true that there's some overlap between convenience stores and refineries. But I don't think that the common question of fact jurisprudence requires that the same question come up in every case. I mean, that's not the case in asbestos. In asbestos, you have premises claims, you have product claims, you have many different kinds of claims. And it's really this intrinsic overlapping, the fact that these are all cases of the same character, that caused both the federal court in 1991 and this panel in 2003 to decide that asbestos cases, because they're so much alike, even though there are individual differences, ought to be handled by a single pretrial judge in the interest of efficiency. And so I think if the panel is looking for a single common question that comes up in every case, it's not applying the statute and the rule as it was intended. Because the only kind of case in which you can really do that is a case like the Hurricane Rita evacuation bus fire case, in which you do have that unique situation.
I know we're cutting into your rebuttal time, but I do have a question while you're on your direct here about the constitutional implications And were you prepared to address that? Because that's obviously an issue. If we're dealing with something like asbestos and personal injury claims, I'm unaware of any constitutional provision that may prohibit consolidated proceedings.
Yeah, I'd be delighted to address those issues. There are two constitutional issues that have been raised. Both arise from provisions in Article 8 of the Constitution. The first is Section 1-E, which prohibits a state ad valorem tax. Transferring these ad valorem taxpayer appeals to a single pretrial judge does not create a statewide ad valorem tax. The local taxing authorities remain the bodies who assess the tax. And because of the way the MDL Rule 13 procedure works, local judges and juries remain the ones who make the final determinations on valuation. So I don't think there's a credible claim that there's a violation of Section 1-E. The other provision is Section 23 of Article 8, which says there shall be no statewide appraisal, and there also shall be local judicial enforcement. And again, the appraisal, even if we have this transfer, is not going to be done by a statewide MDL judge. That ultimate determination is going to be made by the local judge and the local jury at trial when the case is remanded.
But isn't that going to be based on your expert's testimony of methodology?
Well, it will be influenced by that. But I don't think that having a judge in some other county act as the pretrial judge and make pretrial rulings that are non-dispositive would rise to the level of violating the Constitution by turning that into a statewide appraisal. I mean, I guess my answer is that that's an incidental issue, procedural issue, and that the Constitution is complied with because Rule 13 assures that the case is going to be remanded and tried by the local authority.
Would you agree that at least part of the judicial enforcement would not be local if we had a transfer, at least part of the judicial enforcement?
Well, I want to think a little bit more about what enforcement means. When I read that, I thought judicial enforcement is the ultimate decision.
Well, we've already determined that the Rule 13 judge could actually render a determinative summary judgment,
which I think would not be at all likely in these kinds of cases because I don't think they lend themselves to summary judgment. But I would certainly acknowledge that if this transfer were granted, judicial decisions would be made in these cases by the MDL pretrial judge rather than by the judge in the court where it was originally filed. I mean, to the extent that's responsive to your question.
It is, thank you.
But it's also very clear, because of the way Rule 13 works, that the ultimate decision on valuation, based upon the testimony that the jury hears, is going to be made by the local jury and the local judge.
Thank you.
It's my understanding that there have been a couple of Rule 11 tax consolidations not under the Rule 13 MDL, but in Region 4, I think, some consolidated tax cases that were heard in front of Judge Christopher. Do you have any knowledge about those cases and how that worked and whether that worked? And I don't think they were ad valorem tax cases, but I know that they were a group of consolidated tax cases.
What I know is that one of the lawyers involved in that at one point in time told me he was doing it, but I'm not familiar with those. If that's of importance to the panel, we can certainly look into that and address it. I just don't know. I think we've got about 8 minutes over, so I'll sit down if the court has immediate questions.
That'll be fine.
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Tibbs. As promised, particularly to those on the bench, we'll take a short recess. And I'm thinking that my watch says it's 10:45, and we'll be back at 10:55 and begin with the respondent's argument. Thank you. We're in recess until next time.